The following takes place between 6 p.m. and 7 p.m.
Hello, and welcome to Tech Access Weekly, a podcast of unspecified length concerning news and events in accessible technology. This is episode 41 for May 18th, 2010, A Fairy Tale Wedding. So much for this being a quick production. Preparation for this podcast has taken officially over an hour.
It's all because someone else is working the mixer.
Yeah, and someone else didn't plug the Adderall into the mixer correctly.
Yeah.
So, you know. Anyway, we'll leave all of our bickering aside for future contemplation.
Someone doesn't like hardware.
And someone doesn't like me using hardware.
Somehow I seem there being a cause and effect there. Maybe not.
Someone doesn't trust his partner.
We're going to leave that one right there, folks. We're not going to go any farther.
Well, I was the one who said we weren't going any further, and you took it further, so.
I know, I had to.
Yeah, well.
Because everybody was wondering.
Mm-hmm.
After you said it took so long.
Mm-hmm. We don't have that much to talk about since we were just here last Wednesday.
And Friday.
Now we're back again today. We will begin with a Windows Microsoft little blurb, although we don't have any security updates today. We did want to talk about the release of Office 2010. Seems like just yesterday they released 2007. But now I believe they're releasing a business version of 2010?
They've released 2010 business version. They haven't quite set a release date on the online version or the personal version for consumers, but they're trying to get it the word out to businesses that it now is the time to do an upgrade.
And I read an article that they had this really posh meeting someplace, and they brought all these business people to it and said, if you upgrade, then we really want your feedback and we'll work off of that. So to try to give them an enticement to upgrade, they wanted to make it look like they were really wanting user feedback, since that's been such a big thing lately with in the news, that Microsoft has not really gone off the feedback of its user base.
Yeah, very true. Very true. They tried to put a better effort forward in doing their Windows 7 update way back last year, trying to get consumers involved in the process.
Right.
Windows Office 2010, I should say, is one of those things where do you upgrade, do you not upgrade? The verdict's still out. There's not really an idea. Apparently, they are expanding the use of the ribbon so that it goes across all platform applications for Microsoft. You either love it or you hate it. Apparently, there's going to be like a backstage area for applications. Like for Microsoft Word, you would be able to go to the backstage area, which would have a lot of your root things that you might normally do, like margins, page formatting, and things like that. I believe you can even set it up like a dashboard with tools and settings that you most often touch. So that's kind of a good thing.
Yeah, that's nice.
Biggest improvement apparently is going to be in Outlook, where they're going to try and thread conversations sort of like Gmail or Mozilla Thunderbird does.
Windows Live Mail does that too, though.
Does it?
Mm-hmm.
I really don't use it that much.
I hate it, but I use it, and I can group messages by conversation, and it's a very handy thing. I had to get used to it in the beginning, though, because I would delete. If you delete the root message in the whole thread goes, if you're not careful.
Yeah, and that's been one of the complaints that early users of the beta have said, was that you can easily want to keep one message out of the several,
but
and you can accidentally delete them all.
Right.
So there's a few things that might entice people. Mm-hmm. Outlook, I guess, is one of the things that everybody's saying is outstanding. So we shall see.
We shall see.
Now, in something that we really can't segue to, LimeWire has gotten into a lot of issues with piracy.
Yeah, LimeWire is a file sharing company. I guess they have a whole network of services, but one of theirs is file sharing music. So they got into a row with the Recording Industry Association of America, otherwise known as the RIAA, and a judge recently ruled in the RIAA's favor and prohibited LimeWire from sharing for providing their peer-to-peer services. I'm not sure exactly what the ruling covered, though.
They were saying that at least 93% of all information traded and shared on LimeWire was actually copywritten.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that none of the proper channels had been used to get rights to share or use the materials.
But how is this different from other file sharing services that the courts haven't gone after, like SendSpace or RapidShare or Dropbox even?
Well, I guess the problem with LimeWire is the fact that it is a piece of software that people install.
Oh, well.
So it's kind of like in 2005, they went after Grokster because it was kind of like that. They had went after Kazaa a little bit before that, Napster, because it was a software that actually provided access to things. And you were sharing freely, something like Dropbox or SendSpace, you're controlling who gets access to
it. Okay. I wasn't really certain how that worked.
So there's other sites out there, like I believe there's one called BearShare or something that does kind of the same thing. I'm not sure really how it's different. I really hadn't ever used LimeWire.
No, I never had either.
I used Napster back in the day.
Ooh. Yeah, you use Napster, all right.
Yeah, I filled up a hard drive way back when gigabytes were few and far between and ended up having to burn things to CDs.
Ooh.
I believe I filled up a hard drive to the point that I had only had just a little bit of space left and I burned like 20 CDs worth.
Shh. People are going to turn you in if you keep talking.
That's true. I allegedly did this, but then I purchased all of the software and all of the
music
and I deleted the illegal copies. Thank you.
Shh. Moving along.
Moving right along, we will head into the Pennsylvania school spying case that gets more interesting.
Yeah, a judge had ruled a few months ago that the school district pictures and things were to be sealed up and the federal government who was prosecuting the case would not have access to them. This was to protect the privacy of the individuals involved in the situation, the students whose pictures were taken. Last week, the judge ruled that the federal government can have access to all of that information that was previously sealed off. So this will, I guess, greatly help them in their prosecution of the case.
And apparently they have been found to have taken about 60,000 images.
The number keeps growing, so I'm really not sure what to believe. I mean, it was a couple thousand, then it was 40,000. Now they're saying 60,000. I just don't know.
Now, originally it was only like 42.
42 was the original.
You know, that was the original thing, and now it's just continuing to grow and grow. So,
did it ever occur to anyone that perhaps the software was like stuck and just continued taking pictures? Did it ever occur to anyone that there was like this weird glitch or something and it just kept going, sort of like Media Monkey did the other night with the stream from the internet that you were streaming?
I haven't heard anyone really give that sort of a theory. So that's kind of an interesting thought.
Because, I mean, it was playing the last 30 seconds of a stream 15 or 20 minutes after the stream was done.
Yeah, it just sort of got locked with whatever it had buffered, I guess.
So what about the camera? I mean, could those have gotten locked and just continued to take and take and take and take?
I mean, it's possible. I mean, the software is actually controlling the camera. So if the software ran amok, yeah, it probably could do that. But, I mean, it seems like all indications are that the school administrator or whomever was actually using it for inappropriate.
Right. But 60,000 pictures? That just seems a little excessive. Even if someone was being inappropriate, that still seems excessive.
Well, I mean, hey, this day and age, you have to watch the nutrition of kids. I mean, mm-hmm. kid might have ate 6 bags of Cheetos.
That's true.
And you had to watch him consume all 6 bags mm-hmm. in order to know. So, I mean, that would be a lot of pictures.
Mm-hmm. Let us continue with yet more gripping, interesting stories.
Yes. there has been a study released that says that in the United States, landline usage has decreased yet again for telephone service.
Mm-hmm.
In America, there appears to be 25% of Americans, mostly between 20 and 35, 25% are using cell phones only,
mm-hmm.
Not using a landline, not paying for a landline. Out of the people that actually do have a landline, 15% of those do not even use the landline, even though they pay for it.
Sounds like us.
Yeah.
We don't pay for it. We installed them, but...
Well, we got rid of the...
We got rid of the service, yeah.
Yeah, we got rid of this landline service,
mm-hmm.
which the CDC, who was sponsoring this survey, has found that it's impacting researchers because the phone marketing doesn't have the cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. they're not getting through to people on landlines, which are public numbers.
Right.
So their research numbers are actually going down.
Mm-hmm.
People can find more information on that at thecdc.gov.
Well, they're going to have to find alternative methods of getting their word out.
Yeah,
I can see the internet as coming in very handy there.
And that's kind of where they're trying to go and try and figure out how can we get people to actually go to websites to do surveys because mm-hmm. telephone service is not getting it anymore.
Uh-huh.
And then some people, like we do, we use Skype for some landline calling
mm-hmm.
Just because it's really, really cheap.
Exactly. And provides pretty good quality for the most part. Actually, I think sometimes better quality than a cell phone.
Well, we have said that your grandmothers can mm-hmm. actually hear you better on the computer mm-hmm. as opposed to on a cell phone
right.
or regular telephone.
Because my grandma, who's, bless her heart, over 90, almost 92, can't really hear me on a cell phone. I talked to her for 5 minutes a few weeks ago on a cell phone, and she thought I was my mother. But if I call her on Skype, she can hear me, not perfectly, but a lot better and clearer.
I don't know. Maybe the microphone just projects the sound and nullifies noise around
your
voice.
I don't know. It might do that.
But anyway, we can move right along from the exciting news stories that we've already picked to some accessibility things.
The site called openlibrary.org has been coming along recently. This site aims to provide accessible DAISY digital books to the visually impaired community. So far, the books that are on the site are typically public domain books like you can find on Project Gutenberg, but they do have people who are donating books to be scanned in, sort of like Bookshare, although I think unlike Bookshare, it's a free service. Like Bookshare, you have to be eligible. They will accept the National Library Service assurance that you're one of their patrons, and so they'll accept you. But unlike Bookshare, you don't have to pay for the service. Bookshare is a subscription-based service, and this open library thing is not. Apparently, it is free, and you can download the books from the web. Now, it's wonderful for people in the United States, but I have no idea what they're going to do internationally, if they're going to open up and become an international provider or not, sort of like the Internet Library on Internet Archive, rather. So for now, these tokens from NLS are sufficing for U.S. residents, but I don't think they're opening themselves up internationally, and it'd be interesting to see how they handle that situation.
Yeah, I hadn't really heard whether there's a book service abroad. I would assume mm-hmm. there is.
I would hope so. Although I do know some people in other countries are really, really jealous, not jealous, but really wish they had the book privileges that we do in the U.S. with the National Library Service, being able to download digital books from them and essentially keep them.
Yeah, the only problem I see with the Open Library is the fact that it's mostly open source books, if you will, public domain things.
Well, it's moving away from that, though. They're getting donations of more current material to scan, as I said, into their database.
Yeah, but if they start going with copywritten things, it's going to end up being like the Google.
Well, that's the thing. I don't know how Internet Archive and Open Library, which are essentially doing the same thing, are couching their terms, if you will, to be different so that what happened to Google is not going to happen to them.
Hmm.
I'm not sure about that.
Should be interesting to see what the difference is.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's probably going to come down to they have to be public domain books.
Well,
you know,
maybe.
I mean, Apple's iBook store can't mm-hmm. throw out books that are copywritten because of the publishers.
Yeah.
You know, if someone still holds rights to it,
mm-hmm.
you got to pay them royalties somehow.
Right.
And if it's a free service, are they going to inundate their website with
advertisements? What are they going to do? I don't know. Speaking of books, the DAISY Consortium has released a new digital DAISY authoring tool called TOBI, T-O-B-I. I looked all over the website, even on the developer site for this stupid thing, and can't figure out what it stands for. So if anyone knows, please let us know, because I'm really curious now.
It's named after Toby Keith, the country performer.
Yeah, but he ends his in a Y, doesn't he?
I know, but they probably didn't want a copyright infringement, so they changed the name. I don't know.
Oh, well, anyway, it does not, you can't really produce text. It will take text, audio MP3s that are, you try and work into a DAISY format, and text written with Microsoft's DAISY plugin and in OpenOffice, which also has a similar plugin, and you can edit it, redo the tags, make it more navigable, and all that sort of thing. But as of now, as of this first release candidate, you can't create text or audio in the program and have it put it together. It has to come from another program already done. But they're saying that this creation facility could come soon for this product, so keep an eye on it. You can get to it by going just to daisy.org. The only drawback I see, and it's probably going to be a big one, is that this is not a product that I believe works on Macs. I think it's only a Windows-based product. Based on the developer's site when I looked at it, looked at the downloads, and I don't know if there's any movement to get the product to a wider, I guess, computer set, like Mac and Linux, to include them in that either, or if it just includes Windows. Not sure about that.
Yes, always the same story. You mm-hmm. have to go after the largest audience, and that's going to be your PC mm-hmm. users, and probably a lot of visually impaired folks like to use netbooks because they're cheap and inexpensive for
right.
reading.
There's also two more things I want to mention. Speaking of open source, there is a project called the Oats Project. I think it's oats.org.
Sponsored by Quaker?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
But it's a group of software producers who are getting together and trying to come up with and develop accessible software for the visually impaired, I think it is primarily. I don't know what kind of software this is, whether it's like word processing software or whether it's something even more involved like screen reading software similar to NVDA. I just heard about this a couple days ago and didn't really check into it. I was going to talk about it more next week, and in fact, I might. But I just wanted to alert people that this is a new growing project out there, and maybe, hopefully, we'll see some good open source things come out of it. One last accessibility thing that doesn't really relate, but is important to a lot of blind Twitter users. Quitter version 4, the release candidate of version 4, was released yesterday, and there are a lot of good things in it. One principal upgrade is that Quitter now supports Twitter's lists feature. So anyone who likes to create lists, we have some on our TA weekly account, lists of things that are important to them. You can do that with the latest version.
And two, on our list, we've got a list for visually impaired. So when we find folks that seem to be interesting that mm-hmm. are visually impaired or blind out there on Twitter, we try to add folks to that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you know people that might be good to have in that list, you can let us know.
Exactly.
And then all you would have to do is follow that list. And then as people get added,
mm-hmm.
you would automatically be able to build the community of VI folk.
Yes. So that's something good to know. Moving along from Twitter and Quitter
to
the wonderful world
of Google.
Exactly.
And Google, since this is a big issue coming up, privacy, Google mm-hmm. has been found to have been collecting Wi-Fi information from users since 2007. Apparently, they have collected 600 terabytes of data from people's open Wi-Fi, which means as their Google Map Mobile was going around mm-hmm. and taking pictures of people's homes and yards and buildings and landscapes and that kind of thing. They were also checking for open Wi-Fi. So if your home was sitting there and you had your internet sitting wide open, didn't have WEP or WPA, hopefully you're using WPA instead of WEP.
Sort of like Jennifer's neighbors.
Yes, Jennifer's neighbors that we had discussed back in, I believe it was episode 29?
Something like that.
Somewhere in there. She lost the internet. Her Linksys disappeared.
She was pirating off her neighbors and getting their, essentially using their signal.
Yes.
Broadband. Anyway.
It came up on the Tech Guy with Leo Laporte, so if you're really interested or you missed that episode, you can go back and listen to one of our episodes, or you can look for that clip on YouTube. But apparently they try to do a service so that, okay, you're looking for a place on Google Maps or Google Earth, and it will pop up and it will say, hey, if you're in this neighborhood, you could possibly get a little jolt of open Wi-Fi by going down this particular street.
Oh my gosh, really?
Yeah. So, well, it's kind of like Starbucks. You could type in and it'll show that there's a Starbucks,
I guess,
20 feet from you, that kind of thing.
But the question is, people, I mean, this was, some of this data is from 3 years ago, so how many people have wised up by now and
it wasn't really, I mean, you would have had to been at home using your internet, and they would have only collected just a few seconds of your traffic. Google has said that this was a glitch in software and that they were technically not supposed to be getting anything, but they really didn't think anything of it since it was only like a 2 or 3 second snafu of data.
Well, 2 or 3 seconds equals 600 terabytes. 600 terabytes? Is that what you said?
Yeah, but they're going down every street, every road, taking pictures of buildings and all that kind of thing. So
did they say what they were going to do with this data?
I believe they're going to actually get rid of the data now, since it has caused questions about privacy and security. I don't really get the big deal about it. Everyone's kind of just not having an issue with the fact that Google's going up and down the streets showing everyone's houses on the internet or business establishments, but they're worried about this little bit of Wi-Fi.
Probably they wouldn't be as worried if all the Facebook snafu wasn't hitting the fan.
Yeah, but the Google thing, looking at the Wi-Fi, I mean, these are evidently people that don't care about their privacy anyway because they didn't set up security.
Maybe they don't know, maybe they weren't aware until recently what could be done with that.
Maybe. I don't know. But folks, if you're out there and you're using a internet router, just keep in mind that people up to 300, sometimes 400 or 500 feet can actually still access your wireless network. In our house here, I can look for wireless networks and I can pick up about 10 within range that you probably could connect to, but most of them are locked down. So you definitely want to use WPA encryption or WPA2, something like that. Not WEP, because that's very easily to decrypt. But
let's move along, Jerry. You're going to bog people down with all this tech stuff.
We'll move right along to the wonderful world of Facebook, because Facebook is getting slammed like crazy over their privacy as well.
Otherwise known as Faceville.
Yes, Faceville.
Anyway, they are getting slammed over their privacy, just like Rodney said. And we've been talking about that on and off over the past couple of episodes, so I won't bore you with what they've been doing. But the response has been very interesting all across America and the world. People are constantly wondering how to delete their Facebook account. And indeed, if you do a Google search on deleting Facebook account is one of the first things that pops up.
I think it's actually in like the top 4 or 5 Google
suggests. Something like that. And there is even a page on the Facebook website protesting all of the stuff that they've been doing privacy-wise and talking to people about possibly deactivating or deleting their accounts. A lot of guys in the tech industry, I shouldn't say guys, I should say people, but most of them who have talked about it have been guys, are deleting their Facebook accounts. Cory Doctorow deleted his. Leo Laporte, I believe, actually deleted his on air the other day.
Yes, during the latest episode of This Week in Google, he deleted his account. they kind of almost talked him out of keeping his account just because he could create one message that says, hey, you can come find me at my blog at leoville.com, but he still decided that he would go ahead and delete it. Apparently, you have to deactivate it. You have to not touch it for 14 days, and then supposedly it's gone. No word as to whether your data is actually gone.
I think it's, if you deactivate it, the way I understood the articles that I read is if you deactivate it, Facebook will hold on to your data. You have to do something else to delete it. There's another setting you have to hit. And it, when it comes up, he'll say, you sure you want to delete it? Your friends will miss you. He gives like little profiles of the people that will be missing you.
Yeah,
you and have you to, say yes.
Yeah, you have to deactivate it. And then there's also a button that you have to go and find down in the massive tree of crap.
that is Facebook settings.
That is Facebook's privacy settings in order to actually say, yes, I want to delete this account. There's a website out there, wikihow.com, wikihow.com, that actually has a how-to on
deleting Facebook accounts.
Yeah.
I'm strongly tempted.
Well, I mean, we don't really use it. We don't really put that much information out there. We mostly feed our Twitter to it.
That's mostly what I use it for. Yeah. I occasionally will look at people's status updates and respond to what they say or things about them, but I don't tell people a lot about what I purchase or take a lot of quizzes or anything like that.
Well, I think Leo's biggest concern was, okay, he's using it. He doesn't care about his privacy because he's a public figure. He knows how to set the settings, or he attempts to know.
Right.
But he was more concerned that he's has people following him from his radio show that's more of your general tech users that may not understand all of the settings. And he didn't want to sort of coerce them into saying, well, you know, Leo's on Facebook. I need to see what he's posting on Facebook, so I need to join.
Right.
You know, and then they don't know anything about the settings that they need to do. Mm-hmm. So he decided that instead of compromising his brand, he would just go ahead and pull the plug on it. Although he's considering going back. I guess Jason Calacanis, who called Mark Zuckerberg, hard word for us Southerners to say, he called him an Asperger. That was what he called him. I don't know whether there's a reason for that.
Yes, there is, actually. Jason Calacanis said last week that Mark Zuckerberg is a businessman who, he thinks, suffers from Asperger's syndrome, which is rather like a mild form of autism, in a sense that, that I don't believe he does. I think he was joking. But in a sense that it gets hard for people to like connect with other people socially. And people with Asperger's syndrome generally have much less of a social skill set than Mark Zuckerberg does. So I don't think so. But I think that's what Jason meant.
I don't know. People that say they have hung out with Mark don't really give him that big of a social persona, you know. But anyway, the internet is calling for people to quit their Facebook, and they have designated May 31st, 2010, which is Memorial Day here in the United States, as Quit Facebook Day. So if you are so inclined and you feel like you need to close and delete your Facebook, you can do it on May 31st to make a statement. I believe they have a website out there that you can find and sign up saying that, yes, I'm going to delete it. And I believe it's only at 2,000 people so far. So it's not really getting large populations of folks from the 400 million that are on Facebook.
Interestingly, though, this whole Facebook fiasco of drama and distress has inspired people to try more vigorously to develop open source social networking platforms. We've talked in a very small way about One Social that was trying to do that. There's another one that just started called Diaspora, and they have been requesting funds to develop. And as of last Tuesday, they had, what was it, $40,000 worth?
Well, on Tuesday of last week, they had $20,000. On Wednesday, when they got written up on the front page of CNN, they had $40,000. As of today, which is Tuesday, what day is it? May 18th. 18th. they now have $181,000 pledged to them by 5,000 plus folks.
Wow.
And all they wanted to start this was 10,000.
Mm-hmm.
So their goal is to create a secure network that you can put on a web page or a server that you can share information with,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to sending it to someone else.
Right.
Seems like a good idea. I don't know if it'll ever pick up.
I don't know.
Because
that kind of requires a little bit of technical know-how. I mean, even if you want to put WordPress on your own, host your own WordPress server, for instance, that requires some kind of know-how.
Well, yeah. I mean, WordPress has WordPress.com. Then mm-hmm. they have WordPress.org, where you can actually install it on your own server.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what this is sounding like. They want to develop a system where you know what your privacy is, you know mm-hmm. what's confirmed to be shared, what's confirmed to be public,
mm-hmm.
and they're supposed to be able to say, okay, you're sharing this link. Are you sure you want to share this link?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
but what I'm saying is a lot of people don't have the technical expertise or patience to want to do that.
Yeah. And
just to be social.
And that's what the big question is. I mean, this is four guys that are going to college in New York, and they really don't, they have a plan, but how they're going to pull it off and actually get people mm-hmm. to adopt it, because you have to kind of get the public and the herd of 400 million people mm-hmm. to actually adopt it.
Right.
And there's like a Twitter clone out there called Laconica
mm-hmm.
that Leo runs, that does his Twitarmy
mm-hmm.
site, which is like a homegrown Twitter open source type thing. And it's never really caught on because everybody goes to Twitter. What were you thinking?
A fairy tale wedding took place in Japan last weekend. A couple was married in Tokyo by a robot. In other words, the robot conducted the ceremony, and the robot's name was I Fairy. I don't know a whole lot about this. There's a lot of pictures on YouTube, apparently, of the couple posing with this robot.
Yes, evidently a researching robot or something.
Evidently. I'm not sure exactly if this was like some kind of scientific experiment to see how, I don't know, to test the robot's interactions or what the deal was.
I don't know. There's not a whole lot of information on it, but it is just something goofy out there mm-hmm. as to why anybody would want to be married by a robot.
Yeah. And in researching the story today, I typed robot marriage into Google, and I got some rather disturbing things pop up. Apparently, in 2007, there was a huge debate, I guess, in scientific circles, because people published something on MSNBC stating that he predicted, some researcher out of the Netherlands, predicted that humans would be marrying robots by the year 2050. That is a completely different thing from being married by a robot, but I still found it sort of interesting that there was this whole debate about this in 2007 about something even more drastic, and I never even knew about it.
I wonder if there was a article way back then that said that people would marry anime pillows.
I don't know. Robots were in there, so anime probably wasn't too far off. Maybe they consider that a robot.
I don't know. That's.
But anyway, people being married by a robot, I don't really know what the point is. So if anyone knows more about the whole thing, we'd love to know. I mean, was this a scientific experiment? Were these people just being silly? You know, what was the deal? So anyway, we put that in our what were they thinking slot for this evening.
Maybe this will lead to something for Detroit automakers. They can have wedding chapels outside of the manufacturing plant. Instead of going to Vegas and see Elvis, they can go and see the robot marry people that put hubcaps on cars.
Oh, there you go. That works.
You did such a great job on my hubcaps. Why don't you marry me?
Mm-hmm, exactly. Now, the question is, legally speaking, what sort of, I mean, if this is really a serious marriage and not just some kind of weird experiment or something, what sort of status do these people have? Are they legally married or what? That's another thing. I don't know anything about Japanese law and marriage. So
I don't know. But apparently you can become ordained in, I believe it's California. There's mm-hmm. a church that you can pay $50 to print out your collar, and you are an ordained minister.
That's really sad. But yeah, I mean, here in the U.S., you don't have to be married by a minister. But and each state has its own different laws on that. Usually a justice of the peace works just as well. But it has to be a person. So a robot, I'm not sure about, but it'll be interesting to talk about this in the future, I guess.
Definitely a strange thing.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, I think we're finished.
Well, not quite.
Oh, not quite?
No, because we started this whole fiasco of a podcast that we said was going to be short and quick, which mm-hmm. turned out to be pretty much like everything else.
Pretty much.
Really short and quick.
Right.
We started it out with a jingle.
Yeah, so what?
What was the jingle?
What was it?
Yeah.
Mushroom FM?
Yeah.
What about it?
Well, why are we playing something for Mushroom FM? Were we doing this live on the internet? No?
No.
Okay.
We were only doing that because I will begin a broadcast on Mushroom FM from 7 to 9 Eastern. That's 2300 to 1 UTC on the first Sunday in June. So I guess that would be June 5th or 6th or something like that. The show is called The Melting Pot. It will be a melting pot of whatever, a mixture of music, comedy, and book reviews, as well as a couple of other ideas I have floating around in my head someplace. But I have practiced, and the stream went well after a frantic 10 or 15 minutes when I had to reconfigure something with the aid of Jonathan Mosen in New Zealand. Thank God for Skype. And so that will be starting at the beginning of June. So if anyone is interested, you can go to mushroomfm.com and find details on all the presenters, including myself.
See, now, was that so hard to promote yourself?
Oh, that's what you wanted me to do?
I was trying.
Oh, I guess I didn't realize that.
I'm going to have to get you a talking to by Dvorak or something so that you always keep saying, like, Dvorak.org/blog.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess I'll know next time.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you have to plug, promote.
Oh, that's true.
Or else no one will know it's there. And then you'll just be talking into space.
That's also true.
But it seemed like in your test run, everyone was pretty enthusiastic about the things you were playing.
Yeah, everyone seemed to enjoy it. It was kind of funny. At one point, somebody asked me if the music was being sped up at all, and I had to run out and say, does it sound normal to you? Because at that point, anything could happen. But apparently, the person thought that, remembered the song being slower than it actually was. So, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter, but I thought it was kind of funny that that happened, and at that point I was thinking, well, anything could happen, so it's quite possible.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
And we will mention, as we try to always, if you would please take a moment and go over to our website at techaccessweekly.com and complete our PodTrack survey so mm-hmm. that we can learn a little bit about you and what you enjoy about the show or wish would change.
Exactly.
And if you want less puns and less talk, I don't know that that's possible.
But we can certainly see what we can do. And we have also updated our contact information at the end of this to include our Delicious and Twitter information so we don't have to burden our commentary with it.
Exactly.
So we will sign off until next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye. To contact the team for Tech Access Weekly, send an email to techaccessweekly@gmail.com. You may follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/TA_weekly. You may comment on our voice line at 260-2-ASK-TAW, 260-227-5829. To find a list of the stories covered in each episode, please visit delicious.com/techaccess. Feel free to visit our website at techaccessweekly.com.